Good afternoon, and thank you, Nancy. As you mentioned earlier, I'll be talking to you about migrant agricultural workers in Lebanon, our harvest of shame. First, I have no conflict of interests. Lebanon is located on the Mediterranean Sea and is predominantly bordered by Syria at its north and east. Agriculture accounts for 7.3% of the country's GDP. In the past decade, agriculture was responsible for 20% of total export earnings and was the main source of income for 30 to 40% of Lebanese, although only 12% of the labor force is employed in the industry. However, this employment figure may be a vast underestimation, as many workers are undocumented and go uncounted in official statistics. There are about 680,000 hectares of agricultural land in Lebanon, and in the Bekaa Valley, the Bekaa Valley has the highest percentage of land dedicated to agriculture, which represents the major income-earning sector and employer in this area. This is a picture of the Bekaa Valley taken from the adjacent mountain. Official statistics do not accurately reflect the number of migrants working in Lebanon. Although the number of migrant Syrian workers was estimated at over 200,000, only 471 were documented by the government in 2006. This process of labor migration is the result of an unofficial understanding between the Lebanese and Syrian governments or authorities, which provide both countries mutual benefits. Over the years, Lebanon has become an attractive destination for poor, unemployed Syrians crossing the border and residing mostly in the Bekaa Valley. The agricultural sector in Lebanon depends largely on these migrant farm workers. A study was carried out to identify the most pertinent issue relating to the working and living conditions of migrant farm workers residing in the Bekaa Valley. The study followed a qualitative design using field observation and interviews with migrant workers at their homes. A thematic analysis identified the most important issues perceived by the workers. I'll show you now the results. Unemployed in their place of origin, workers migrate to Lebanon even if work situations are precarious, in the hope of finding a steady income for them and their families. When asked about work in Syria, one of the migrants replied, "There is no work in Syria, and if there is, the pay is at most $2.50 a day. Here in Lebanon, it is better." The availability of agricultural work is highest during the spring. Late in the agricultural season, there are fewer jobs, and many of the workers go back to their place of origin and return the next season once work is available. The Shawish is a broker, a middleman, who brings workers from Syria to Lebanon and finds them jobs in farming. The literal translation of the word Shawish is sergeant, a law enforcement officer. However, in this case, it is used to refer to a figure who is in control. In fact, the Shawish controls the migrant workers' access to work, and he negotiates the wages with the landlords or the employers on their behalf. Migrant farm workers come to the Bekaa Valley with their families. The entire family contributes to the household income. Women and children work in agriculture, dairy farms, and poultry. On average, they work 8 hours a day. The average daily rate of pay for male workers is between $10 and $16 and is $5 to $7 for female workers. The pay disparity between men and women is not explained by differences in task assignment or daily hours of work. Children are also expected to carry some financial responsibility and begin working at the age of 12. Despite national legislation disallowing child labor, there have been cases reported of children as young as 8 working in the fields. Agricultural tasks include plowing, planting, applying fertilizers, spraying pesticides, and harvesting, picking fruits and vegetables. Tasks also include irrigation in the fields, moving and stacking fertilizers, as this woman is doing in the picture, The dog is not helping. The farmers also clean the vegetables after picking them. The workers in the picture are removing soil from the potatoes to pack them in boxes that are later sent to the market. Although this task takes a while to finish, please look at the awkward workstation, and the body position of the workers. Nobody tells them to do it otherwise or differently. The occupational environment for farm workers in the Bekaa is unsafe and unhealthy. Workers have been observed working with pesticides without adequate personal protective equipment. The agricultural sector in Lebanon relies heavily on agrochemicals to protect crops and improve the yield. Chemicals are abundantly used and in some cases abused, according to the Lebanese Ministry of Environment. This leads to workers' high exposures, of course. We saw workers in the fields for prolonged hours in very hot, sunny conditions, few if any wearing hats as protection. Similarly, workers are not provided ergonomic tools to assist them in lifting and moving heavy objects. Hence, workplace injuries, including musculoskeletal symptoms, are very common. If workers are injured, minimal first aid is supplied at the work site, and for more serious injuries, health services are far distances away and inaccessible and unaffordable for the workers, who are not covered by any insurance or compensation. The interviewed workers talked about the harsh economic and living conditions they face. Migrant workers live in housing clusters of 10 to 300 tents. The land where the tents are clustered is managed by the same shawish who brings them from Syria. This shawish rents the landlord from a landowner for approximately $650 per year, and this shawish controls and manages the housing properties where the migrants live. We tried to avoid taking pictures of the workers in the field because we did not want to upset the shawish. The shawish charges the workers rent, about $130 a year for renting a tent on the land, $30 per month for service water, and $1 per every 12 liters of drinking water. This adds up to $30 each month for a family of three and $150 each month for a family of 15. As for electricity, the cost depends on the usage and the type of appliances in the tent. Conversations with migrants established an estimate of $30 a month as a reasonable approximation. Electricity is provided by the shawish, who extends a cable from his generation to the tent, paying for this service. Whoever pays has to pay. Whoever gets the service has to pay. These expenses exclude other survival necessities, such as food, health, and other needs. In addition, the shawish deducts $1.30 of the workers' daily earning as a finder fee. This ensures that the workers remain impoverished and dependent on him. The workers' insecurity resulting from their poor socioeconomic and fragile legal status allowed the shawish to take advantage of them, overcharging them for services and negotiating their low wages. What about the housing conditions? Some old billboard covers the roof that will not withstand most weather conditions. Rubber tires are placed on the roof to hold the structure in place. Each tent accommodates up to 15 people. There are as many people in this tent as the number of mattresses on the side of this picture, although sometimes the mattress would accommodate more than one person. There are about 12 in this picture. This is an outdoor bathroom that is shared by occupants of several tents. And this is the laundry. The picture on the left shows the room in the tent that is used for showering. The shower, water is heated on a stove, then taken to this room to be used. Wastewater is drained through a small canal to the outside of the tent, as shown in the picture on the right. The migrant workers living in the tents suffer from overcrowding, insufficient lighting, insufficient ventilation, leafy roofs during rainy rainfall seasons, insufficient insulation during extreme weather, too cold in the winter and too cold in the summer, and of course, poverty. According to the workers, living in these conditions is very difficult, but they have no other choice. Children play with junk as toys. They run around barefoot in areas with sharp objects, rocks, and other hazards around. Most of the time, these children are workers. They help their parents with farming duties. Diet consists of carbohydrates, potatoes and bread, sometimes vegetables, although they are producing the vegetables sometimes, the vegetables themselves. Meat, chicken, or fish is consumed only on rare occasions. And by the way, the workers we spoke to were not vegetarians. The migrant workers lack access to medical services. These, too, are unaffordable. And many migrants take care of medical conditions upon returning to Syria, where the medical services are cheaper. If I had money, I would have taken my daughter to the doctor. As she is not able to speak, I would have tried to treat her. This is the girl who cannot speak here in the picture with the pink shirt. Children spoke about their hope for a better life and an education. As a child put it, when I grow up, I wish for my kids a better future than mine. In conclusion, migrant workers in the Bekaa Valley live in unhealthy and inhumane conditions that entrench social and health inequalities. Families are exposed to unsanitary and unhealthy living conditions and exploitation. Poor access to primary and secondary health care, tremendous social, economic, and health inequalities, and a drought of governmental resources and services all contribute to these workers' vulnerability. Although agricultural work is one of the most hazardous occupations, it has not been considered an issue of social justice or human rights in Lebanon. In 2010, I wrote this article titled Agricultural Workers, Double Marginalization. It was published in a widely read political newspaper in Lebanon. It described the precarious conditions of migrant farm workers in this country. Until now, aside from my faculty colleagues and my friends, no government officials, NGO, or even advocate groups have contacted me to inquire and follow up on this issue. Nobody wants to see, nobody wants to hear. The problems facing migrant farm workers' communities are complex. To address them, professionals and advocates must work together to develop holistic analysis of the multi-level factors that contribute to the workers' poor working and living conditions and to their vulnerability. These include political obstacles, such as immigration policy and expansion of rights to migrants. Social hierarchies also should be dealt with, such as the worker-shawish employer or landlord relationships, and environmental conditions that influence health. Many of these factors are interdependent, and interventions must be tailored to address the specific root causes of the problem. Occupational health professionals cannot do this in isolation. They should share these duties with labor advocates in this difficult work. The spotlight must be brought onto migrant farm workers who are now absent from the research and intervention agendas in Lebanon. Is this occupational health? What is she mumbling about? Is this talk on occupational health? Where is the science, as one of my colleagues at an EPICO conference asked? You are addressing workers' living conditions at their homes. What is it in it for occupational health professionals? The bewilderment of my colleague was exacerbated when he learned that I was trained in occupational epidemiology in Australia, where I did a retrospective cohort study of 8,000 nuclear industry workers to correlate cancer incidence with protracted low exposure of ionizing radiation and had estimated the excess relative risks by levels of exposure. My answer was, yes, of course, it is occupational health. I got enlightened when I saw how workers live in the other side of the globe. And I remember your talk, Hester, at one of the EPICO conferences when you assured the occupational epidemiologists that you are one of them. It was a very moving keynote speech. You enlightened me, thank you. Grounded in past social movements, the field of occupational health aims to provide a framework that weds scientific inquiry with concepts of social justice. Workers are people too, as Nancy Krieger puts it. Allow me to use it in this context. Even if in its most traditional definition, occupational health aims to ensure the health and safety of workers at the work site and on their way to work, as Iman Wahid puts it in his powerful presentation yesterday. Well, I can confidently tell you that in the Bekaa Valley, these migrants' workers' only way from their place of origin to the work site is a miserable tent. There are many people I wish to thank, all the workers who invited us in their homes and accepted to talk to us, my research team, Lubna Haidar, Safah Jej, and many others who worked with me on this project, including my GAs, Karim and Samira, my colleague, Rami Zray, for his brainstorming session on farm workers issue before the start of this project. I also wish to thank the occupational health section at APHA for trusting me in organizing this session. I tremendously wish to thank Nancy Krieger for accepting to frame and moderate this session. And I also thank my faculty. Without their support and my dean, I wouldn't be here today talking to you. Thank you very much. If you are interested, we also have a booth of our faculty in the exhibition area, so please come and talk to us. We'll tell you more about migrant ag workers as well. Thank you.
Great. Well, because our speakers were all very conscious of their time, we actually have 25 minutes for discussion. I think we've heard three presentations that very importantly bring together different aspects of what workers' lives are like in different global contexts, but connected at the same time by certain powerful global forces of the economy, and particularly in the neoliberal frame that we currently live in and many of us challenge. So what I'd like to do is open the floor for questions to each of the speakers, and let's take it from there, please.
Thanks a lot for these incredible presentations. I really appreciate it, specifically from you and everyone. It was very enlightening. I would like to come back to the topic of the informal sector, and in a way I would like to contradict two of the underlying assumptions. I think they lead us in the wrong direction. I do not think that, well, I don't think it's true, so to say, that the informal sector was created by globalization. It is there since hundreds of years. And we can discuss if globalization raised it by 2% or lowered it by 2%, because there's also the positive effect of globalization, job creation, middle class, etc. I think it's a complicated discussion. When we take the example of India, we have 92% informal unregistered sector. That was before globalization already. So I think it's not true to connect the two in that kind of similar way. The second thing, I think an assumption which leads us in the wrong direction is that the informal sector is not organized. My experience is that it's highly organized, depending on the branch. Two examples. The one is we have association of retail drivers. We have the association of street vendors in the cities. We have even countrywide and region-wide associations of migrant workers. It's highly organized. The second example, when we look at the unorganized sector in agriculture, which is about 70-80% of the total informal sector in Asia, the agricultural informal sector is highly organized. The little illiterate farmer knows exactly where to get the seeds, where to get the pesticides, and he knows exactly how to contact the middlemen and find out the price in different markets. It's highly organized. It's just not visible to us who think in traditional forms of organizations. But we had discussions in India a lot that we could not use this kind of internal organization of the informal market, even take industrial informal sector, which produces up to 30% of GDP. They know exactly where to sell their goods. If we could use these kind of transmission chains of products to actually get knowledge about the patient health into the informal sector, like labeling of chemicals, labeling of pesticides, working with the sellers of pesticides in the plastic bottles on the markets, etc. It's highly organized. I think we cannot say there is a lack of organization.
Thanks for that. Those comments. Yes, I would agree with you. I think in terms of the history that you place about informal informal activities being historical, going back hundreds of years, I think that I would definitely agree with that. But I think I would certainly argue that globalization changed the nature of it. I mean, you know, you can't argue about the you can't argue that the pre-industrial type of informal sector work is the same as what we have in the post-industrial time. So I guess that's what I was coming from. As far as the organization goes, yes, once again, I agree. There's extensive networks that exist, and but it tends to vary. With the informal stone crushers that we worked with, there were networks, as you say, they knew exactly how to operate within the economy that they were operating in. But they weren't unionized, so that's one. And I was trying to argue that the them having a voice. So within the ability to engage with the powers that be, those informal networks have not achieved that level of strength in terms of that. But I agree with you. Those networks exist. It varies from country to country. Thanks.
Dr. Habib, you mentioned that you didn't take pictures, not wanting to offend the Shabish. Can you or any of you comment on how you establish trust relationships to be in these environments where you needed to draw the line on how far you could go and what you saw or what you captured on film?
Actually, the Shawish was okay with us being there, but we were scared for the worker. What about he gets angry at them later on? Because his livelihood is dependent on them. By the way, the Shawish is a figure from that community. And this community is marginalized. There is a double marginalization there, because there is the landlord, the Lebanese landlord, who is very happy with what's happening because he's negotiating very low wages with the Shawish. And the Shawish who brings the workers from Syria is also benefiting from exploiting these workers. The Shawish is okay as long as we don't cross some of the boundaries. We did not want to upset him just in case he would retaliate at the workers. That's what we had in mind, actually.
And I apologize. I think being a little bit more facetious and sort of pushing us. I'm trained in environmental health, so I deeply believe in these proxies. I mean, at some level, I've been enculturated into believing these very proximal exposures and how they impact, right?
And so,
I was just reifying, reinforcing, because I think it's, we don't problematize this in environmental health, to be completely frank. And it's, we always say the and that's why Dr. Krieger's work echoes with our, resonates well, because you know, she's trying to get us, and we're trying to get away from this proximal distal sort of bind that we're in, and can we understand proximal exposures, and really care about proximal it's not far away. Structure is not far away from these folks, not even from ourselves. And how do we, in a paradoxical present, in this presencing mindful framework, understand the structure of segregated policies that impact everyday lived experience? And we have to figure out how to bring those into our proximal kinds of work, and really problematize that, and say, well, over and beyond just taking. Counting how often you connect to a source, a polluted source, in addition to that, how is that connected to all these other kinds of things that you're experiencing in your lived everyday life world? And how is that shared intersubjectively with others? And that's where we have to push ourselves, because most often, I'm gonna be able to say, I'll give you that exposure, right? I'll mark it down, publish it, and there you go. You deal with it, social behavioralists. Or policy people. But we have to take a stand as environmental health scientists and say, wait a second, we have to understand at this moment in time what this exposure means to these folks, and not to just these folks on the ground, but all these networks that connect to these folks. Does that sort of get to your, it's a paradoxical space that is not sans like sociotemporal frames, but is really getting us away from just this sort of binary of understanding, we're just looking at exposure, right? And exposure for us should push us to say environmental exposure is just more than this fungicide. Environmental exposure is more than just even segregated living conditions. It's more than just the musculoskeletal assessment that we do in the field. And it's more than the epi that we do. How do we integrate this, though, in a systems way? For us, the answer has been participatory, and it's so challenging because understanding how we include people in the process of understanding risk and what that risk is, we've been trained about what risk is, right? But cultural understandings of risk, we don't necessarily incorporate into our assessments. We don't necessarily say, hey, what is your risk? How do you conceptualize risk? Do you really feel like you're in the field and that is your ultimate priority risk that you're experiencing your occupational related health or disease or illness experience? Instead, we go, okay, I can quantify your exposure. And I'll tell you, and I'll tell, you know, forums like APHA what your exposure is. But I'm not, as an environmental health person, telling you that exposure is sociopolitically, historically contextualized in a flow of geopolitical, neoliberal, whatever, you know, all of this stuff that exists within that life world. I'm not telling you that. And in a way, I've stripped that pathway and that life world to a particular part. And that's our frustration with this. And part of the reason why we have really tried to aim towards more participatory method, the harder way, not necessarily the higher road, but the harder way of engaging with farm workers, paying farm workers to engage in our research and to say, hey, how do we even conceptualize what you feel is exposure, given the deep structural conditions that you exist in a consistent, persistent, sustained segregation. And a feeling of I'm walking invisible. You know, I'm walking in this valley where I'm dying, but I'm not even visible. I'm not even recognized. So.
I'd like to also address these comments somewhat in role of moderator, because I actually think that the framing of things as proximal distal is highly problematic, because it allows for a false cleaving of that which is actually happening in the moment. And it's happening in the moment, and it's happening in our bodies, and it's happening in our communities. And I think that we have to also ask, what does it even mean to say proximal distal? Does it mean spatial distance? Does it mean temporal? Does it mean something is more proximal because it's in the body? What does that actually mean? Does distal, if governance is directly shaping the conditions in which people are considered to be undocumented, that's right here and now. There's nothing distal about it. And if you look at what's happening in Arizona now, there is absolutely nothing distal about it, about what's happening going across the border or not. So I think that that becomes a form whereby the politics, in a sense, gets stripped out of the science. And it's not that there's not something that's objective in some ways about science and what we do. I'm a scientist. I believe there's a shared biophysical reality in which we can contest and compete over what our ideas are and test hypotheses and have replicate. We hope to be able to replicate things, that there's independent scientists working. That's fine. But what are the questions that we actually ask? And are the questions to what end? What knowledge will this serve for whom? And I think that even on the question of participatory, it's actually very complicated. We just had a whole Spirit of 1848 session that was about issues of co-optation, including some very serious reflexive work on what is going on with community-based participatory research. How is that itself being co-opted so that it's actually not about transformation and not about changing conditions? So if our science is in part to understand the world in order to change it, which is actually part of the mandate of public health, we have to move out of this framework of what's split. And then what it may mean in a particular study is we actually do. I'm an epidemiologist. I do study specific exposure and exposure associations with regard to different outcomes. I think about those things. I absolutely test hypotheses. But with the idea of where is that knowledge meant to serve whom to change what? And that might not be in the actual measurement of what I'm specifically looking at, but it actually will be at times, and I'll say something on that in a moment. But it absolutely be when what's framed is in the introduction, it will be framed in what the interpretation is, it will be framed in terms of who I'm thinking about needs to know this information, and where did that come out of what discussion before I even did the study. So those are questions that absolutely come right then to the core of the science, and there's absolutely nothing distal about that. And even in terms of measuring those proximal exposures, I mean, the work that we've done with the United for Health cohort, for example, in Boston, is that we can look at adverse conditions that are experienced on the job, but we also look not only at the physical exposures, the social engagement on the job, the racial discrimination, the sexual harassment, but we also look at what's happening in people's communities, and we bring these things together because, in fact, your risk assessment and your exposure, you may miss completely important confounding or effect-modifying variables and actually come up with an inappropriate interpretation of what the risk estimate actually is. So I think that these things are not extraneous, and to the extent that a framework continues to be used that says this is proximal and this is distal, we're not forced to actually do the hard work of the thinking through and thinking with, because I think what comes across in what these different presentations is about is that it's not enough to go in only in this role of outside scientist. It's actually to be engaged, understanding we're changing the world we live in because we think it's unjust and having consequences for health, among many others. It's not to prioritize health among all everything else, but people do actually care about health. They care about how they're doing, they care about their friends doing, they care about how their kids are doing, they care about their families are doing. I mean, all that's there. Where does work fit in the picture? And I think that the other point I want to make in comment to the first question that was brought up is that, yes, we have to have jobs, but jobs on what terms for whom? There have been free trade agreements that have been incredibly injurious. And we look at where the income flow goes in this country right now, just in the US alone, with what the gains have been to the top 1% and the decline in wages to everybody else in terms of real standard of living. I mean, we're not back to where we were in the 1960s. So these become larger questions in which we're not going to be adjudicating or dealing with occupational health hazards. So we need to keep the connections visible and transparent and alive, because that's going to be the force that's going to make for change.
Services, perhaps immunization services, general health care services, but there's also a role that requires organization for us to get. Governments only respond to services that are demanded of them, and we need to always be really conscious of that. And so I guess what I'm getting at is that I think that it's useful if we articulate not just the government needs to provide services, but that perhaps government needs to provide some structure to this informalness that's out there. Perhaps that the government can help regulate a system of the way waste is marketed or rock is marketed, provision of minimum wage standards and enforcement of such standards, provision of housing, not that they provide it, but a required housing be provided. That I'm just saying that I think there's a broader kind of perspective we need to have about the role the government can play rather than just purely providing a service or industrial or physical.
I agree.
My question is basically the point of this type of research is to really draw attention to these injustices that are occurring. But considering the difficulties in studying these marginalized populations, what do you see as the most important role for science in terms of drawing attention to these issues, especially in marginalized populations where it's hard to do these exposure assessments?
That's a good question. I think our research team struggles with consistently because we always, at the end of the day, say so what. And so what in terms of the relevance to, for instance, my discipline that I was discussing earlier, environmental health. And you know, there's at multiple levels of action that we need to engage with. But specifically speaking, in terms of environmental health, is how we need to push our field in different ways. I don't know how effective, as a scientist on the ground working with Haitian farm workers, we truly are. I think it's always an evolving process, and it's a process of give and take and a mindfulness of action together. That is not necessarily, I don't know how you can how we capture that often. In units of service, or in whatever, however you wish to evaluate or measure that. And our hope is just that we're trying to do honest, authentic science. But more importantly, in environmental health, how do we get our colleagues to think more critically and more interdisciplinarily together? How do we not just engage in partnerships where we are with another epidemiologist, associate behavior, you know, like these sort of translational science teams that come together, descend upon a community, and do whatever they want to do. But how do we understand ourselves as professionals and really push ourselves to think more critically about our science and how the implications of that science have effect over time? Because it's never, you don't just drop in, it has a real effect over time that is iterative, that is synergistic, that's additive, that is consistently evolving. And how do we push ourselves to get away from just the mere risk assessment, risk communication model that we're consistently in circles around, but really push us to say, okay, can we do risk analysis differently that connects to a deeper sense of social theory and push ourselves to really do action, engaged action, at the way that we can do engaged action. Because not everyone can do what everyone else does. We have to find our own way. I don't know if that gets to what you were getting at. It's hard to be on the ground. I mean, I get frustrated on the ground. It's hard to hear that one of our informants who we've been paying, that we in good faith think we're engaged in a critical dialogue around the science of exposure, that they come back and, you know, they've lost their folks to the earthquake, they can't, there's just so many competing everyday issues and everyday life worlds that I don't know, it's hard to be on the ground to say, hey, how are we really helping and how are we advancing this science with you? Other than just being truly trying to be honest on the ground, given the structural corruptions that exist in the everyday of our science. But I'm sorry if I didn't get.
I'll take one more question and then I'll make a closing comment, please.
Fanny Sharp from Alexandria University, Egypt, and I am very happy to hear that and to share you that very important decision. And actually, in Egypt, we share you some of these problems, but actually not to the degree with the car. But here, I agree with all of these discussions and with the comment of the role needed from government, because our problem in developing countries is the segregation or separation between scientific work and governmental work, or how to provide the real solutions and the real services and to get it into action. I could summarize these problems into three aspects. There is some need for strengthening legislative aspects for the informal sectors, and there is a need for enforcing the organizational aspects, and the need for enforcing training of the involved participants in providing services for proper risk assessment and provision of what is really needed. So the main problem is the segregation between scientific and research workers and the governmental and the proper agencies providing the services. The role of scientists and research workers is to clarify problems, to diagnose the community problems. The occupational health problems in the community is diagnosed by the occupational health scientists and the universities. And of course, a framework of action and a framework of solutions to be applied to the reality should be well structured and well prepared. Of course, we may have some pilot studies in testing the proposed solutions for the real ground of the problem, but the whole problem to be solved, such declaration, suggestions, and framework should be submitted to the responsible body, and we should not be exhausted. We should do this more and more and more and more until we get solutions and get to, until we get our plans into action. Thank you.
So as a closing comment, I'd like to say I think that what the session is really importantly doing is putting, again, the occupational health work in its much broader societal context. There's also government and government. There are very repressive, autocratic, dictatorial governments. There are governments that have much more progressive agendas. There are governments that are very split in what's behind them. There's no simple appeal to government, but what is important still is establishing a principle that we actually do believe if we want government and have true participatory democracy in government, that actually puts different kinds of demands on what we're asking for, and not just asking for, but actually demanding and transforming and changing. Because I think the thing is that absolutely, because we're in an age where many say, well, we just need to have private-public partnerships, that we have the idea of the further destructuring, as it were, of the state, of getting rid of welfare state, that provisions that have been very importantly fought for, including in this country, including occupational health. So it's a very complicated question. So if you ask about what does this mean for people in occupational environmental health, part of it is in what's happening in the pedagogy, training people in the field to put the work in context so that you actually can understand that, yes, you absolutely need standards of evidence, but how are they going to be acted on, because evidence alone never does anything except be evidence. So how do you actually begin to put that context in place, have it become part of the discussion, the understanding the history of occupational environmental health, where have there been setbacks, where have there been victories, what has enabled that, what has constrained it. I think these become part of the just education of any public health professional to know the content of our field. Also not look only to the social sciences. In fact, I've become very interested recently in late work in what's called political ecology, looking actually at ecological sciences, partly because in many social sciences there have been many compromises with the powers that be to stay the social sciences that they are. So you want to look sometimes not only in what looks sort of there, but also look at other levels where in ecology there is absolutely explicit theorizing that deals with multiple levels, that deals with interactions, because ecology is nothing if not about interactions, and engagement. And I think it can give us some other frames to start to think about and push our own thinking. So I think these all become questions that get raised of where And it's never to minimize the importance of the specific exposure data that are obtained to know that harm is being done. But what's driving that becomes really crucial. And if we can't speak to that, we're not doing full justice to what the science is itself demanding. So I think there's actually hopeful notes, because I think if you consider the conditions that have been in the United States and other countries 100 years ago, where there is now, it's not the same. It's because of what's been engaged struggle that makes the difference. That has to be taught and understood, but that there's also so much work that has to be done. And we're a part of that. We're not all of it. It's never like one particular profession is going to solve the whole problem. But if we're not making the connections to the people in and outside the professions, in and outside civil society organizations, we're not going to see the change we need, and we're not going to be part of making that change happen. So on that note, thank you very much for coming to the session. Thank you again for all the work that's been presented here.